Welcome back to the program. Eric Fischel is one of America's most celebrated and accomplished artists. At a time in the 80s when painting was declared dead, he and others of his generation persevered and gave new life to art, often through celebrity. Through the years, Fischel sought to bring his work and his life into harmony, and in so doing has constantly strived to reinvent himself and his work in order to remain relevant. His newly published autobiography, Bad Boy, My Life On and Off the Canvas, proves that he has succeeded. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome Eric Fischel to the program today to talk about Bad Boy. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. It was interesting. One of the pieces of press material with respect to your book says that Fischel recounts the full arc of his life thus far. Why now? Why at this time did you decide to write this?
I wish it was a good answer, but it actually was some evolving process through conversations with a guy I played tennis with, who's a journalist, and got interested in an aspect of my past, which is the years I spent at California Institute of the Arts in L.A., which also was a time that produced many artists that went on to impact the art world in the 80s. So he thought that would be an interesting thing to investigate, and our conversations moved along those lines and then evolved into a more specific conversation related to my work, and then expanded it into my life. So had it started out as something where I was approached to write a memoir, I would have said no.
Talk a little bit about that time at CalArts and what the atmosphere was like and what the view of the art world was like.
Well, you know, it was a school founded on a paradox. It was the original vision of Walt Disney, and Walt Disney, his vision was to put all the arts under one roof, which hadn't been done before, and to sort of seek a certain kind of cross-pollination in the creative arts. He was a kind of utopian visionary, Disney was, but his utopia was based on an imagined past. But they ended up hiring some very avant-garde people to run the school, to guide the school, who were utopian visionaries also, but their vision was of a utopian future, a sort of non-existent utopian future. And so when the school opened its doors, there was immediately a kind of clash between these two cultures. There was, you know, a kind of right-wing politics and a left-wing politics that were involved in it. And it created a dynamism that was incredibly exciting. It was the end of the 60s. It was Southern California. It was like anything goes kind of cultural attitude. There was a belief that in order to get past the past, you abandon it. So they didn't teach you history. They didn't teach you techniques or anything related to the past art making processes. And they kind of expected you to teach your teachers.
And after you left CalArts, you made your way to Chicago for a while.
I did, yeah. At a time when most of my peers were moving to New York, which at that time was the center of the art world. It no longer is, but it was the center at that time. I knew that I wasn't really ready to compete at the highest level. My sort of work was a mess, my head was a mess, and whatever. I needed some time to pull myself together and begin to ultimately make the work that I would make. So I went to Chicago, which is a dynamic city, but a smaller scene than New York, with different kinds of pressures.
One of the things you talk about is how the art world and views of art were different in different places around that time, that New York was different than Chicago, and that was different than the West Coast, and even Los Angeles and San Francisco had differing points of view.
Yeah, well, as I said, New York was considered the center of the art world. It controlled the media, it controlled the financial At the time, the museums were, you know, sort of the greatest international museums, et cetera. So it was sort of the place to go. Europeans came, as well as American artists went there. The artists that stayed home, the Chicago artists, the L.A. artists, San Francisco artists, for example, were generally considered, you know, either regional artists or provincial artists. Worse would be a provincial artist. And there was a tremendous prejudice to that. And the school I went to at Cal Arts, they absolutely upheld that, even though we were in California. They looked on L.A. and San Francisco as, you know, sort of minor artists. Over the years, they've been proven wrong, that those artists have all emerged as dynamic international figures.
Mm-hmm. By the time you made your way to New York in the 80s, many people viewed art or the business of painting as being dead, as you talk about. Talk a little bit about that atmosphere and what you were up against.
Yeah, I mean, the culture of the new was what gripped the art world, and so the anything that had a deep traditional base, and of course painting and sculpture of a certain kind, had the deepest roots in tradition and stuff, were looked upon as passé. Painting no longer dominated the image-making process. Photography had usurped it. You know, soon film, animation, all those things would move into the center of the culture as an imagistic kind of interpreter of what it's like to be alive today. And so painting was seen as passé, you know, a craft at best.
It was viewed as old technology, I guess, in a contemporary sense.
Which of course it is.
Right.
It's a very old technology, yeah.
Over the years, you've actually managed to bring in some newer technology to it in some of the photographic work you've done in combined with your painting.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I have to say that I am first and foremost a painter, and that's not a choice. It's actually the process of putting this sort of greasy material, this colorful greasy material onto a canvas or something like that is a way that I form language. It's the way that I communicate. It's the way that I understand myself on levels that are deeper than, you know, my thought processes. So for me, there's no choice about painting, but how I approach the painting, of course, has evolved over the years. Once I began to work with figuration and began to work with narration, the narrative moments, I looked to photography as a starting point, and I derived figures from different photos that I took, et cetera, that I would then collage on at first directly onto the canvas. And then as Photoshop came into being, I moved it into developing my studies on the computer first and then going to the canvas after I kind of found something more or less that I wanted to paint.
Going back to New York in the 80s, talk a little bit about that period and some of your colleagues during that period and just the absolute craziness that existed in that time, which I think would be hard for people to really grasp who weren't around then.
Well, we turned out to be a transitional generation. The sort of the impetus coming out of the 60s and gaining momentum in the 70s was really a socially conscious, politically conscious kind of movement that was about transforming the world through art. And I think we all, my generation, really embraced that idea that art had this power to transform. And, you know, if you look at the work that began to emerge in the 80s, they were all sort of liberation narratives, if you will. They were all, whether it was, you know, trying to, you know, liberate painting from the idea that it was dead, to, you know, putting figuration back into painting, to feminist issues, to racial issues, to gender issues, you know, et cetera. Everybody was seeking a kind of, you know, equal voice and a defined identity. And this identity quest really gripped us. And so when you look at the 80s, there was this kind of boiling stew that was taking place all over the world, actually, for some kind of equanimity and that would also obviously transform the way we conducted ourselves culturally and socially. And so it was a fabulous, energetic, and creative time. It was also, like, infuriating and, you know, and highly competitive and you know, full of craziness. And the beauty of it was that at the beginning, fame and fortune were not connected to each other. And so those of us who were invested in being artists, we all had the ego structure that we wanted to be famous. That is to say, we wanted to compete at the highest levels and be part of a huge historical kind of pantheon, right? What we were willing to accept was that we may have to do two jobs, three jobs the rest of our lives in order to do that. We weren't looking for the art to support us. We were looking for our art to guide us into some kind of new consciousness, new awareness. And so we didn't actually notice what was happening. And I know I really shouldn't speak for others of my generation, but I think that I can say that to some extent we were not very naive and we didn't know how to stop what actually was taking place, which was that fame and fortune were merging and it was changing the entire structure of the art world, so that now it's not even called an art world. It's called the art market.
And people like Mary Boone at the time saw that or had an inkling of that and really took advantage of that.
She did, I think. You know, she was sort of the first gallery in Soho to kind of fancify Soho. She kind of brought Uptown Gallery downtown. And, you know, she was somebody that wasn't, you know, hiding the fact that if she was going to be asking high prices for young artists' work, well, it better look like museum quality, or it better look like it belongs in the finest homes, or, you know, that kind of thing. So she definitely had a sense that, you know, the clients that are actually buying the work are the ones that live in a certain way and you know, want to be seen reflected in that. And so, you know, she did that. She also was somebody who understood the power of the new media and, you know, began to exploit that for her artists.
Talk a little bit about how that competitive spirit of the time that you talked about, how it impacted the work. You and others of the period kind of trying to outdo each other in many respects. How did that impact on the work itself, at least for you?
Well, there was this sense among the peers that you know, people were pushing the envelope, and they were pushing it in different directions, but they were pushing it hard. And you would see, you go to shows and you would see somebody, you know, working with you know, photographic images of self-identity in a certain way. I'm thinking of someone like Cindy Sherman, for example. And, you know, then I would go back into my studio and I would be sitting there trying to think if I had been clear enough, if I in trying to identify the characters in my work. You go to a show, Julian Schnabel, for example, who sort of brought back monumentality to, you know, the 70s saw art shrinking down into a kind of intimacy and a kind of almost like a hippie kind of preoccupation with like stoner art or something, that's like putting kind of funky little things together and just to blow your mind type of thing. And it was all very small scale and temporal. And then Julian comes along and he blows the big paintings back up to the heroic scale. And, you know, he starts really manhandling the paint, could be a kind of alpha dog power to it. And, you know, again, go back to the studio. You know, how do I answer that that challenge? I saw it as a challenge. Should I make my paintings bigger? What would it take to compete at that level? So there was a lot of that kind of thing taking place.
Your decision, as it evolved over time, to focus on being more narrative, on telling stories, image stories. Talk a little bit about that and how that evolved for you.
Well, it was something that I discovered in myself, that in terms of discovered what my actual creative process was. And I did it initially back in the mid-70s when I discovered this paper, this glassine paper, which is a milky transparent paper that allows you to paint oil paint on it, and if you make a mistake, it's easy to wipe off. And I was doing these large black line drawings. What I liked about the transparency was I could, say, paint a chair on one piece of paper and pin it to my wall, and then stare at the chair and say, okay, where is this chair? Is there a lamp near this chair? Is there a person sitting in the chair? Are they walking by? Are they crawling? Is there more than one person? And I would just sort of talk, and every time I kind of thought of something, I would go get another piece of paper and lay it over top, and I would paint that thing, and it would either stay or it wouldn't stay or whatnot. And eventually, after doing this for a while, I began to realize that that's actually how I create. I tell myself stories. And, those stories lead me back into memory, lead me back into buried feelings, lead me back into, a sense of a kind of deeper experience of my life. And so when I began to paint paintings, I took that process with me, only this time I was, painting on a canvas, I was using color, I was using photographs, and I was, clipping this figure out from this photograph, and this dog out from that photograph, and this chair from that, and just kind of painting as I went along, telling myself these stories.
You open the book talking about what is arguably both your high and low point after your retrospective at the Whitney. As the 80s gave way to the 90s and the art world changed, and it certainly became more focused on, as you talked about earlier, the art market, as the styles changed, talk about how you viewed that and how you determined to continue to be relevant.
Well, first I got sober. That helped a lot. I kind of went through the 80s sort of running away from myself at the same time I was chasing myself, and I missed a lot of it. I missed the high points, which were arguably the hardest to really take in. I mean, you want to, in your imagination, in your desire, you want to achieve something, and then when you do, you actually don't know how to process it. It leaves you both full and empty at the same time. And so the 80s was sort of trying to negotiate this success, which I hadn't anticipated, even though I desired it. I had no sense of what it actually meant. In terms of, what is fame and what is fortune. And so I, it took a while, and by the time I kind of you know, sort of stabilize myself, the art world had changed. There was a new group of artists that had sort of captured the imagination of certain kinds of collectors who were now dominating the art world. There were, you know, collectors who were whose instincts were investment oriented and speculative and stuff like that, and they began to really sort of move the art world in that kind of direction. You know, lots of talk about you know, finding the next Picasso, and some young artist collector started going into graduate schools and buying work from students that it had never had any kind of critical attention at all, hoping that they'll hit big. And so, you know, trying to negotiate that at the same time, trying to reassert the things that I had been trying to assert in the 80s, which was authentic emotional experiences as opposed to attitude or style, trying to find some kind of truth. And my comfort zone is not trying to speak in larger terms about what I've come to know as true, but to speak more intimately and personally about it, because it's what I've experienced is what I know, not what I imagine or think about. So it was about trying to hone in on you know, my daily life, my surroundings, and so my work was evolving in that direction.
One of the other things you talk about, and you talk about the influence of John McEnroe in realizing that life and art and everything else had that element of sports in some respects, that you win some and lose some, and the idea is just to win more.
Yeah. Yeah, to keep going out there. I mean, John was terrific in his sort of understanding of that. And, you know, we would talk about competition, and athletes, of course, are very comfortable in the world of competition, whereas artists hide the fact that they're incredibly competitive. And so it was a relief to talk to somebody who embraced competition as opposed to artists who pretend to hide it or pretend that they aren't competitive. And what John, you know, really made me understand was that, you know, the nature of competition is that you're going to lose, and, you know, chances are you're going to lose for periods of time more than you're going to win. And you still go out there and you still do it. You still compete. And, you know, so I took that to heart.
And finally, one of the other things that is so powerful in Bad Boy is traveling so much and having the opportunity to see so much of the world. Talk a little bit about that opportunity and how that has shaped your views over time, seeing and being in so many different places.
Yeah, you know, early on it surprised me too, because I didn't actually think about myself as a big traveler, but then started to notice that I was actually finding stimulation every time I traveled, and you know, one thing led to another, and I began to travel more. You know, just trying to see the variety, see the complexity of life. And what I found is that travel was not an escape for me. It was actually a way of finding myself, because I would go into cultures that were different, and I'd come face to face with my own prejudices, limitations, anxieties, sense of alienation, you know, et cetera. They would be sort of highlighted by the differences that I was experiencing. And so in a way, it was like I would travel to leave home only to find that I hadn't left home, and I would come back and I would make work that was more connected to my sense of self and my sense of place.
Eric Fischel, his autobiography is Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas. It's just out from Crown. Eric, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.